When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
What follows may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
The world is full of stories. Stories of mysteries. Of curiosities. Of oddities. Join Kat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected. But now it's your turn to lift the lid and tell us your favorite story as the Box of Oddities presents Freak Family Favorites.
Hi, my name is Maddie and I'm from Orlando, Florida. I love the Box of Oddities so much, but my favorite box is Box 234, the ghosts of Mount Everest.
The ghosts on Mount Everest. Mount Everest is littered with bodies of dead climbers.
Right, yes.
They've accumulated over the decades.
Now, when you say ghosts, though, do you mean ghosts and not just bodies?
I mean both.
Oh, shit, girl.
Oh, shit, yeah. There are so many bodies on Mount Everest that when you climb to the summit, if you go through the regular route that they take to the summit, you have to physically step over bodies.
Right. And some of the bodies are actually used as landmarks along the way. So like Green Boots like halfway up or something like that.
Yep. In fact, Green Boots is one of the most famous bodies.
Yeah.
His real name, by the way, was Tsawang Paljor. And it is now a landmark on the main northeast ridge route to the mountain. In death, Green Boots has become sort of a guide for the living. He died in a small indentation in the cliff that is a common place for hikers to crawl in and kind of catch their breath and rest up a little bit. He died in there, and that indentation is right next to the main path to the summit, and people actually have to step over his legs to proceed. Passing hikers even occasionally stop for a selfie with Green Boots. Doesn't that seem a little disrespectful?
Rude.
Maybe.
Though, of course, we just casually refer to him as Green Boots.
Green Boots.
And he's a mile marker.
Yeah, good point. Another guy, David Sharp, who was also a fellow mountaineer, entirely different party. In fact, years after Green Boots died, crawled in there to stay warm, and he died in there too, but his body was removed. According to an article on Ranker, Mount Everest is notorious for its corpses. People travel from all over the world, of course, to climb Everest, and not all of them survive. There are avalanches. Of course, a lot of people die from falling, inclement temperatures. All those things prove fatal. Most people die from avalanches.
That's terrifying. Avalanches to me are very, very scary. I mean, no one's like, woo, avalanche. But I've seen some videos of avalanche events. And like there was one where it was just taking out houses. Like it was, I don't even know if it's technically an avalanche or something graded up from an avalanche. But it was just like house, 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 just sweep, sweep, sweep. And it gives me that same feeling that like, I don't know, like heights do, or, you know, something like that, that you just, you're like, my body reacts to it.
I read an interview with a guy who was a skier that got swept up in an avalanche, and he was obviously rescued because he was being interviewed about the event.
Sure.
He said that the most scary thing for him was not knowing which direction was up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I can't, no,
I know.
It's because it's a weird combination of things. It's the disorientation, it's the claustrophobia, and it's the cold. And there's, I'm sure, so much that,
I don't like it.
That's why we're moving to a warmer climate.
In 2017, four bodies were discovered in a tent on the an Everest base campsite. Analysts believe the campers passed away due to altitude sickness. The weird thing is, none of the local climbing agencies reported any climbers missing. Oh. They remain unidentified.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, there's got to be a way that you can, like, scoot past, you know, and make your way undocumented, I guess. So
there are several routes to the summit.
Right.
Some of them are more challenging than others. Most people just take this main route.
Right. But I know there's like a check-in, right, when you go up the mountain that people know that you're there.
It's like two or three different base camps that people will set up, their parties will set up. But the most dangerous route is this particular route, Northeast Ridge Route, near Everest's summit. There's an area there called, they call it Rainbow Valley. Now, that sounds peaceful.
Mm.
But essentially what it is a mass pit of bodies.
Oh.
Yep. The grisly scene got its name because of all the brightly colored jackets and climbing gear that the cadavers still have on, strewn all over this section of the mountain.
That's litter.
Throughout the years, climbers have been known to push cadavers over the mountainside into Rainbow Valley or to cut the ropes of mummified remains so that it's less hazardous as you try to come back down the trail. In this area, a vast majority of those who succumb to altitude sickness or exhaustion or hypothermia, it happens in this area after the summit on the way down.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. That's really depressing.
Mm.
It's like, oh, you've achieved the thing and now you're going to die.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like that. Also, I would think that any sort of dangling rope mummy would be very dangerous, and I can totally understand doing the old heave-ho.
Heave-ho. And so these bodies are just collecting down in this gorge.
That's gross.
And it's just like littered with colorful ski jackets.
That is a horror movie in the making.
According to the laws in Nepal, Everest is considered sacred, and any remains are to be removed immediately. That's the law. You need to remove them immediately. The problem is it's nearly impossible to retrieve remains from this area, which is also called the death zone.
Oh, cheery.
There was this one guy, his name was Peter Kinlock, and he had just summited Everest when he was struck by sudden blindness. Now, this is another problem that people have at these altitudes. His team reported that Peter was in excellent health on the climb up, and they also noted how overjoyed he was when he reached the summit. This was a dream that he had. But due to the high altitude, oftentimes, and this happened in Peter's case, climbers are struck with retinal hemorrhages, bleeding from the cells in the back of their eyes. Ugh. And it can cause blurred vision or just outright blindness.
Jesus.
So he's on top of frickin' Everest and he goes blind. Guides noticed that Kinlock's loss of coordination was starting to become more prominent. At that point, he admitted he could no longer see. So Sherpas tried to help him. He's 28 years old. They tried to help him down the mountain. They shared their oxygen and their medicine with him over 10 hours in hopes of keeping him stable enough until they reached base camp. But the team began to suffer from hypothermia and frostbite. They had to make the difficult decision to leave him behind.
No.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, those poor people.
Several months later, one of Peter Kinlock's friends, a guy named Rodney Hogue, was making his own attempt on Everest.
For why, though?
And he spotted Peter sitting on a ledge. His remains were perfectly preserved by the ice. He said, quote, "When I saw him, I instantly knew it was Peter. You could see his face. It was just like he was lying on his back, taking a rest."
Jesus.
The climb down to Peter was too dangerous to undertake, so Hogue took a moment. He paid his respects to his fallen comrade before continuing on. Now, before Kinlock had died, the Sherpas that were with him had clipped him to a fixed line on the side of the mountain, and that's probably where he will remain until somebody cuts him down.
That's got to be super bizarre to all of a sudden see your dead friend on the side of a mountain.
Yeah, he's been dead for months and he looks like he's taking a nap.
I mean, I would be concerned that I was like Hallucinating.
Hallucinating, yeah. Nobody knows exactly how many bodies are still on Everest, but they estimate it to be just over 280 bodies.
Oof.
Most of them are Sherpas, which is not surprising.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
They reside in the Tibetan-Nepali border area. Interestingly, the Sherpas, when they die, they perish, more of them perish at the lower altitudes, while the foreigners perish higher up, closer to the top of the mountain. I don't know why that is exactly, but that's what statistics tell us.
Interesting.
According to the Himalaya database, most climbers expire either ascending or descending from the summit, mostly descending. Very few die at base camp. Now, there have been very strange and unexplained sightings on the mountain, particularly in this area that I'm talking about, the dead zone, just as you're coming down from the summit. Pemba Dorji, a Sherpa from Nepal, claims to have seen black shadows during his 2004 ascent of Mount Everest. He noticed, "When I paused at a mound of rocks, I saw what looked like spirits in the form of black shadows coming toward me. They had their hands outstretched. They were begging for something to eat."
Oh.
Dorji thinks the shadows are, obviously, spirits of mountaineers that were killed during past climbs. And that's interesting because it's a tradition to leave food near a deceased climber's body on the mountain as a form of respect. Mohan Singh, a resident of a local Himalayan village, he reportedly encountered a very strange man wearing mountain climbing gear outside of his home during the winter months of 2004. He said the sky turned black and the stranger reached for Singh's shirt like he was trying to grab him to keep himself from falling,
mm-hmm.
but his fingers went right through Singh's body, just like a ghost might do.
Whoa.
The stranger's body, he said, continuously changed sizes, growing up to 9 feet tall and then suddenly shrinking to, quote, the height of a chicken. That's weird.
That's terrifying. I mean, your brain must be doing crazy things when your body's being put through that.
Yeah.
That tremendous stress.
Well, that is true. And that's what makes this particular story interesting is this is a resident of a village that is certainly acclimated. Hikers go, you know, in and out of this village on their way to and from.
So he wasn't hiking. He wasn't doing the stressy thing.
He was actually chopping wood.
Chopping wood can be stressful.
In June of 1933, Frank Smythe, while he was climbing, suddenly sensed that he was not alone. He descended from one of Mount Everest's notorious death zone areas, and during a break from this journey, he encountered the presence of a man. Smythe divided a mint cake with him. He attempted to break his mint cake in half, and as he was handing it to this man, the man just slowly disappeared right in front of his eyes.
Oh.
Sometime later, Smythe discovered two dark, bulbous objects hovering over him. He described one of the objects as having a, quote, squat, underdeveloped wing, while the other had a beak-like protrusion, kind of like the spout of a tea kettle.
Okay.
The objects remained pulsating over him until eventually disappearing in a passing mist. Now, that could be explained by the brain's lack of oxygen at a higher altitude, but
sure.
That's still pretty freaking weird.
Yeah, that'd be creepy.
In 1975, a guy named Dougal Hanston and a friend of his, Doug Scott, claimed to sense, quote, a third climber aiding their survival. One particularly brutal Mount Everest ascent. Hanston and Scott were members of the very first expedition that successfully climbed Mount Everest using an uncharted path. So this
was an
arduous journey. The ghostly mountaineer that the men ran into...
I would hope that on that kind of journey, you'd want to hold your head up high. Oh, an arduous journey. Got it.
Not an argent journey.
Got it.
No.
Got it.
Yeah.
Oh, topical jokes, Katrina. Oh, bringing the topical jokes about a band from the 60s.
Early 70s, actually. But
I will look that shit up.
72, Argent, Hold Your Head Up, featuring Rod Argent, former lead singer of The Zombies.
Founded in 1969.
Yeah, but when was that song a hit?
I didn't say when was the song a hit. I said a band from the 60s.
Oh, semantics.
Oh, look at that.
So the ghostly mountaineer So the ghostly mountaineer that the men encountered apparently helped them out. He provided extra company and encouragement. Haston and Scott claimed that the phantom climber helped them make it through the night, and then he just disappeared.
Wow. That reminds me of that story of the woods that kill people you talked about one time. There was a group of kids, and the waters were rising, the rivers were rising, and there was always someone at the river to help them across, but it turns out there was no one there or something. Do you remember that story?
Vaguely. That's called the third man factor.
Oh, that's a thing.
It's a thing. It's an extraordinary account of how people at the very edge of death often sense an unseen presence beside them who encourages them to make one final effort to survive. They offer a feeling of hope, protection, guidance, and it leaves the person convinced that he or she is not alone. Now, Wikipedia says that Sir Ernest Shackleton, during the Shackleton expeditions, wrote in his book, South, his belief that a incorporeal being joined him and two others during the final leg of their journey. Shackleton wrote, "During that long and racking march of 36 hours over the unnamed mountains and glaciers of South Georgia, it seemed to me often that we were four, not three." His admission resulted in other survivors of extreme hardship coming forward and sharing similar experiences. In recent years, well-known adventurers like climber Reinhold Messner and polar explorers Peter Hillary and Anne Bancroft have reported that exact same experience.
Wow.
Some people think of it as a guardian angel. Some people think of it as an imaginary friend.
I'd like to think that if I was in that kind of situation and some sort of spirit being came to me to encourage me to withstand the pressures and persevere, it would be Michael Jordan.
Would it?
Yeah.
Okay. I would follow Michael Jordan's advice.
Absolutely. Michael Jordan could talk me into just about anything. I'd be like, you're right, Michael.
A lot of people say an explanation for this is it's a coping mechanism for the brain. Modern psychologists have actually used the third man factor to treat victims of trauma.
Oh.
The cultivated inner character lends imagined support and comfort.
I like that.
So that's kind of a nice place to end, I think.
Oh, I like that.
On this story, rather than, you know, people stepping over frozen corpses.
Sure, that was nice.
Top of the mountain thing.
Yeah.
And now, that thing in the middle. Rose Davies was raised by foster parents. And throughout her entire childhood, she thought she was an only child. It wasn't until much later, when she was an adult, that she learned she had three brothers. She spent years tracking them down and was finally successful in finding two of her siblings, Sid and John. But her third brother, Chris, was much more elusive. She spent many more years searching worldwide and then finally found him. Chris was living in the house directly across the street from her. Whether they're telling you about oddities or just recording themselves fat, stupid, drunk at a hotel bar, they're entertaining AF. This is The Box of Oddities.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. You know, as your kids get older, there are some things about parenting that gets easier. I remember once hearing my sister tell my little niece, "If you put your pants on, I'll give you some Fresca."
And when kids can start to reason that they get something if they do something right, it's a lot easier to manage them.
Having that conversation about money with your kids, that's not the easiest thing in the world. Fact is, kids won't really know how to manage their money until they're actually in charge of it. And that's where Greenlight can help.
Greenlight is a debit card and money app made just for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on the kids' spending and savings, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills.
Your kids will learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely, thanks to the games that teach kids skills in a fun, accessible way.
When I was a kid, I had expected chores, and then I had bonus chores. And bonus chores were where I earned money. And so if you're thinking like, hey, my kids should be doing stuff around the house, yeah, no, you're not wrong. But maybe there's extra ways that they can learn how to be a successful financial money person.
What was one of the bonus chores that you had to do?
Rub my mom's feet.
And what did that pay?
I don't know, like a quarter or something.
Millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate their life together.
Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/oddities. That's greenlight.com/oddities to try Greenlight for free.
Greenlight.com/oddities.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey, this is Annie from Georgia. I'm a recent member of the Freak family, and I'm still catching up. But so far, my favorite box is 302 about Mike the Headless Chicken. Keep flying that Freak flag. Thanks.
September 10th, 1945, Fruta, Colorado. On September 10th, Lloyd Olson and Clara Olson were out killing chickens. They were going to be having a family dinner that night, and Lloyd knew that his mother-in-law really liked a chicken neck. And so, he was keeping that in mind as he was chopping the heads off of chickens. So they slaughtered about 40 or 50 animals that day, but one of them did not behave like the rest. A 5.5-month-old Wyandotte chicken got up, kicked about a bit, and ran, and didn't stop. Lloyd thought, well, this is different, that this chicken is still chickening after being beheaded. So they placed him in an apple box on the family's screened-in porch for the night. And the next morning, when Lloyd got up, the chicken was still alive.
Shut up.
Well, geez.
Gotta make different plans for dinner now.
So Lloyd took the rest of the chicken carcasses to town to sell them at the meat market, and he took this one weirdo bird with him also. He popped him in the old horse and wagon and started betting people beer or whatever that he had a headless chicken that was still alive. And this chicken was not just not dead. Like, he was still able to balance on a perch and walk, though clumsily. He attempted to preen. He tried to peck for food, unsuccessfully, of course.
Is this Mike? Mike the Headless Chicken?
It is Mike the Headless Chicken.
I think I did this on a thing in the middle, but that just touched on, on it. So,
well, yeah.
You're going to do a deeper dive on Mike the Headless Chicken.
That's what we're doing. Yeah,
nice.
We're talking about Mike the Headless Chicken. Or, if we're talking about his full name, Miracle Mike.
Miracle
the
Mike.
The Headless Chicken. Hi, buddy. How did dinner go? Lloyd decided that if Mike had that much will to live, he would try to figure out a way to feed and water him. So he got an eyedropper and deposited water and food directly into Mike's neck hole.
See, all of this defies science in my mind.
Well, not entirely, and we'll get to that. So it was becoming pretty obvious that this bird was special. And a week into his new life, Olson packed him up and they went to the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, where the chicken was put through a battery of tests.
I just picture a headless chicken on a treadmill, you know, with little diodes on his chest. He's being encouraged to push it. Come on, Mike, you can do it. Get it, get it. And Mike's like, fuck, I don't have a head. And I'm a chicken.
Well, it was determined that the axe had missed the jugular vein and that a clot had prevented him from bleeding to death. And so most of his head had been severed, but most of his brain stem and one of his ears was left on his body. And since most basic functions of a chicken, so like breathing and heart rate, as well as reflex actions, are controlled by the brainstem, the bird was able to remain pretty healthy, considering.
Wow.
what they're called central motor generators, enabling basic homeostatic functions, were still being carried out in the absence of higher brain centers. Keep in mind also that birds possess a secondary balance organ in their pelvic region. So that's mostly for flight. So chickens don't really use that much.
Right,
but
right.
He did have that to utilize while he was tootling about.
I see.
Mike was photographed for dozens of magazines and papers, and he was featured in Time Magazine as well as Life Magazine. A sideshow promoter called Hope Wade had traveled nearly 300 miles from Salt Lake City, and they had a simple proposition. Let's take this bird on the road. We're going to hit the sideshow circuit, and we're going to make some money.
But hurry. We don't know how long that clot's going to last.
So that's when they decided they were going to call him Miracle Mike, the Headless Chicken. And based on how interested the townsfolk were when Lloyd brought Mike into town, he thought, yeah, maybe others would like to see Mike. Maybe we can make some dollars. So Miracle Mike got a manager.
We don't even have a manager.
I know. It's ridiculous.
Good Lord.
This bird doesn't even have a head, and he's doing much better than we are. So they set out on a national tour. The Olsons went to California and Arizona, and Hope Wade took Mike on a part of the tour to the southeastern U.S. when the Olsons had to return to their farm in order to harvest their farm goods.
I'm picturing the Olsen twins.
It's exactly what it is. It's Mary Kate and Ashley, and they have this headless chicken.
I had a dream like that not too long ago. Except it wasn't the Olsen twins and there was no headless chicken.
Okay. Well, there you go.
But it was just like it other than that.
Just like that. Yeah. Can I just say, I'm so proud of Mary-Kate and Ashley. They've done so well for themselves. I know it's hard to be a child actor. They hit up sideshows in New York, Atlantic City, Los Angeles, San Diego, and people were paying 25 cents to see Mike. The bird's travels were carefully documented by Clara in a scrapbook that is actually preserved by her family. Today, they keep it in a gun safe. And according to BBC, people around the country were intrigued by Mike or Miracle Mike, but not everyone was pleased with the situation. One of the letters compared the Olsons to Nazis. However, another person from Alaska asked if they would be willing to cut off one of Mike's legs and put a wooden leg on there instead. So, really,
okay. People
went in different directions.
Yeah, let's keep lopping off appendages until dinner's ready.
Not great. Not a great suggestion. Mail people were delivering letters addressed to the owners of the headless chicken in Colorado.
And they were getting
them. And they were getting these letters.
That's glorious. Because when I order something from Amazon and it looks like it might slightly be larger, just a little bit too large for the mailbox, they don't even try it. They just put a slip in there and make me go downtown and get it.
I know, it's terrible. So Mike's popularity is growing, and his owner is earning about $4,500 per month. Mike is valued at 10 grand, and that is the equivalent to about $115,000 today.
In today's dollars.
Yeah. He's not just gaining popularity, he's gaining weight. Mike gained almost 6 pounds over the next year. I mean, for a chicken, that's a sturdy amount.
Mm.
Especially having to have his food eye-dropped into his neck hole.
Sure.
They're feeding him a mixture of milk and water via an eyedropper. Occasionally, he gets small grains of corn and worms and such, but he's doing okay on that diet.
So they would take grains of corn and just stuff it down his throat with their thumb, like a Pez dispenser?
Something like that. I'm not exactly sure how that...
That's weird.
Yeah, there's some parts of this were harder for me to investigate than others.
Oh, sure.
So,
I understand.
Jamming food down his throat hole was not something I really looked into in depth.
Okay.
In an interview, Olson said that Mike was a robust chicken, a fine specimen of a chicken, except for the not having a head. While returning from one of these road trips, the Olsons stopped at a motel in Arizona, and in the middle of the night, Mike began to choke. They were unable to find the eyedropper that they used not just to feed him, but also to clear his airway, and Mike passed on. This was 18 months after having his head cut off.
That's amazing.
For years, Lloyd Olson told people he had sold the chicken to a sideshow circuit. He didn't want to admit that he had let the bird die. And it wasn't until he was nearing his death that he told his family that the bird died in a hotel in Arizona.
What did he do with it?
According to findagrave.com, Mike's body was lost or destroyed. It was never made clear what happened with the body of the headless chicken.
And there was a recreation of that.
At Ripley's, at believe
Ripley's
it or not.
In Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember seeing that.
I remember seeing that and going, oh, and then I noticed at the bottom it said, this is a recreation. I was like, Ripley's. But if you're on the corner of Mulberry and Aspen in Fruita, there is a statue of Mike, maybe 5 feet tall, an artist's rendition made of old metal implements like horseshoes and hand tools.
Wouldn't it have been cool, though, really, if Mike the Headless Chicken was actually 5 feet tall?
Wow. Yeah.
I'd pay a quarter to see that.
Sure. Also, in the city of Fruita, they have an annual Mike the Headless Chicken Day. I told you I love a festival. It's the third weekend of May, generally. It started in 1999, and events there are the 5K run like a headless chicken race, the egg toss, pin the head on the chicken cluck off, and chicken bingo, in which chicken droppings on a number grid choose the numbers,
and then
you have to bet on which card will get the most poop on it, I guess. In 2019, it's estimated that over 21,000 people attended the Mike the Headless Chicken Day. The festival last year had to be canceled, but they are planning on having a festival this year in hoping to avoid any complications because of COVID. Mm. They have pushed it back to August, but they are planning on having a Mike the Headless Chicken Day once again.
It'll be great to get back to normal.
Right. Yeah, that's what that means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I have real mixed feelings about this story, as you can probably guess.
Yeah, I can certainly understand. I did not realize that he went on the road for 18 months.
18 months.
Wow. And died at a motel.
Yeah.
Like so many other comics and musicians.
Yep. A roadside hotel in Arizona can be a lonely place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sad, but also crazy interesting.
Certainly is.
The way that the chopping didn't really do what, you know, well, you know.
Yeah, I know, you know, I know, what's, you I know. Know we have come across so many bizarre and unusual festivals that are held around the world, really. The Mike the Headless Chicken Days, the Dead Guy Days in Colorado. But maybe that would make a great second podcast, is we go to these festivals.
Oh, my gosh.
And experience the festivals.
I would love
and
that.
And interview the people who are in charge of, like, chicken poop bingo.
Yeah. No, I would love that. And I know you've wanted for years to go to the Electric Flower Rave place. So,
Electric Daisy Carnival?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
me and Skrillex, we're like, you know.
So we could hit that up if you wanted.
That'd be great. I'd love that. I'm going to roll on in there.
Wait a minute. You can't do drugs when we're working.
I don't do drugs at all. Well, I don't do illicit drugs or illegal drugs at all anymore.
Wow, there are a lot of qualifications.
This is awful. This is awful. Let me just clarify. I do not do illegal drugs anymore. No, stop. No. I mean, you know.
What is happening?
I mean, there was a day, but that was decades ago.
No, I just found.
And it was just for a day.
On our YouTube search history, microdosing mushrooms. Was that research for the show?
It was research for the show.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was research for the show. But it's interesting. It's supposed to be really good for treating depression.
Yeah.
Scientists say.
And so, would you like to host your own segment and share your favorite Box of Oddity story? Just record on your smartphone who you are, where you're from, what your favorite story is, and why, and anything else you'd like to share. Then email it to curator@theboxofoddities.com. Copyright 2024, all rights reserved.
If you like this podcast, can we recommend another one? It's called Big Picture Science. You can hear it wherever you get your podcasts, and its name tells part of the story. The big picture questions and the most interesting research in science.
Seth and I are the hosts. Seth is a scientist. I am Molly, and I'm a science journalist. And we talk to people smarter than us, and we have fun along the way. The show is called Big Picture Science, and as Seth said, you can hear it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.